The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. A warm hello to all our listeners and welcome to today's program. This is Alita Khan from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from multiple sources, including Marie Claire magazine, Listening to the Children, TeenInc.com, and perhaps we'll get to Positivity.com as well. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at www.kiwanisfoundation.org. And let's begin with an article from Marie Claire magazine, the December 2016 edition. And this is on Jennifer Aniston. Having gracefully navigated the pitfalls of fame, Jennifer Aniston, who stars in this month's raunchy comedy, Office Christmas Party, is charting her next destination. Jennifer Aniston likes working from home, and once you see her home, it's not hard to guess why. Up, up, up the steep, windy roads of Los Angeles you go, through discreet, dark green gates that open as if by magic, and into a sumptuous, modernist compound that might best be described as the Aman that friends built. Aniston stands waiting in the massive front doorway, tiny, tanned, and smiling. "Hi," she says, ushering me inside, along with her three boisterous dogs, Dolly, Sophie, and Clyde, who are clearly working hard not to jump up on the guest. At 47, Aniston has the wry humor of someone who finds life alternatingly fascinating and baffling. Her feet are bare, her hair is tawny, her husky blue eyes twinkling. "Come on in," she says, guiding me through the house, our charcoal-toned hugeness of glass and air with dark wood floors and endless views out over the city. The art is big and modern, the furniture long and low, with a few well-chosen statement pieces. A Chagall here, a massive amethyst crystal there, a pair of oversized ebony hands framing the fireplace. "I get very involved with doing my houses," says Aniston, who bought the place with her then-boyfriend Justin Theroux in 2012 and was married to him here last year. "Luckily, I worked with an architect who didn't mind." People tend not to mind when it comes to Jennifer Aniston. In fact, most of America can't get enough of her, even though it's been 22 years since Aniston first leaped into our living rooms as the spoiled but lovable Rachel Green on Friends. She is the reason people drink smart water and use Aveeno skin cream and Living Proof hair care products, and will see this month's comedy Office Christmas Party, co-starring Jason Bateman and Olivia Munn. Think of Hangover meets Ferris Bueller's Day Off, plus drunk Santas. "People just love her," says Aniston's best friend and producing partner Kristen Hahn, who recently produced the indie dramas Cake and The Yellow Birds with Aniston. "It's a blessing and a curse. For the most part, Aniston has handled her fame with remarkable grace and good humor. But in July, she had finally had enough, publishing an op-ed piece in the Huffington Post in which she socked it to the tabloids over their endless obsession with whether she's pregnant, reminding women everywhere that we don't need to be married or mothers to be complete. We get to determine our own happily ever after for ourselves. When I ask Aniston why she chose to speak out now, she laughs and says, "You mean why did I pick this moment? Why did I pick this moment in time to cough up my 15-year-old hairball?" She curled up on a gray sofa of the kitchen, drinking iced green tea. Theroux is out of town at the moment, shooting The Leftovers in Melbourne, Australia. "I think I finally just got fed up," she continues. "I was in a really raw place. My mom had just passed away, and we came back from vacation, and all of a sudden, we had paparazzi on us like crazy." For much of her life, Aniston had a famously troubled relationship with her mother, Nancy Dow, who wrote a tell-all memoir about Aniston in 1999 called From Mother and Daughter to Friends. But the pair reconciled after Aniston's divorce from Brad Pitt in 2005, and Aniston spent the month of May caring for her dying mother in Los Angeles, an experience that she describes as extraordinary. I was literally in her hospital bed with her, giving her morphine, cradling her like a baby. She pauses, her eyes bright. You know, it was a tough relationship. We had a tumultuous experience, but never did we not love each other, and I feel that we have a deeper connection, having gone through that. It was such a beautiful full circle, taking care of her towards the end. Aniston shakes her head. Afterward, you kind of sit back and you go, gosh, all of those silly fights, all of that wasted time, all of that stubborn behavior. I learned so much about her after that broke my heart. She just wanted to be loved, but she didn't know how, was what that looked like. Aniston was still grieving when she and Thoreau returned from the Bahamas in July. The couple had no idea they'd been photographed and no idea of the heyday the tabloids were having with the pictures of Aniston in a bikini. We were on an island, and when I tell you I never saw one human being, I mean it was really remote, says Aniston. And all of a sudden, when we got to New York, we were hounded by this ridiculous amount of paparazzi, and they just, day after day, increased. Eventually, she realized that there was a magazine, and I was pregnant for the umpteenth bazillionth time. They had a photograph of me with a circle around my abdomen, an arrow pointing to it that said bump. She shakes her head. If I can add up over the last 15 years how many times that's happened to me, I just got sick of it. Aniston initially started writing the op-ed as a cathartic meditation, but the essay quickly ballooned into a broader exploration of the scrutiny that all women in our society endure around our bodies and our relationship status. I just thought, why are women seen this way, says Aniston. My marital status has been shamed. My divorce status was shamed. My lack of a mate had been shamed. My nipples have been shamed. It's like, why are we only looking at women through this particular lens of picking us apart? Why are we listening to it? It was Han, a bridesmaid in Aniston's wedding to Pitt in 2000, who suggested that she publish the piece. Aniston agreed on the condition that Han would edit it. She took a machete to it, says Aniston, chuckling, which was good because the thing was like 12 pages long, and I really didn't care when I sat down to write it. I just thought, I have worked too hard in this life and this career to be whittled down to a sad, childless human. One of the funny things about hanging out with Aniston in person is how remarkably unlike a sad, childless human she seems. The woman practically glows with mirth. In 2 weeks, the news of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie Pitt's divorce will hit the internet, and Aniston will be dragged yet again into the public eye as part of the world's most famous love triangle, with GIFs of her in various states of gleeful vindication multiplying across the Twitterverse. But if she has any sense of the madness that's about to descend, you'd never know it. And while part of this mirth is probably due to her marriage, a lot of it seems due to the fact that Aniston actually knows how to make herself happy in life. She meditates and does yoga regularly. She eats well. She appreciates a fine tequila. She invites the spiritual counselor Mitra Rabhar over to give lectures about the Chinese New Year or astrology. And perhaps most important, she hangs out regularly with a tight-knit circle of girlfriends whom Aniston has basically considered her family since she was in her 20s. I owe everything in my life to those girls, she says. It takes a very powerful personality to survive within the bubble of celebrity, and Jen has one, says Han. She has a healthy sense of herself. She doesn't play small in the world, but she's also great at celebrating everybody else in her life. I'll write a script like that, like seven people will care about, and she will throw a parade like I just won an Oscar. She hasn't lost perspective. While Han is reluctant to talk about Aniston and Thoreau's relationship, she will say that in a house, it's a house full of laughter. When you're a comedienne at her level, it takes a lot to make you laugh out loud, but he will actually make her laugh. Aniston knew pretty much instantly that Thoreau was the guy for her. They became good friends on the set of the comedy Wanderlust in 2010, and she thought, that's the kind of guy, like, that's a goal. Where is that kind of guy who connects to human beings so beautifully and really listens and is so creative and present and a problem solver and a crisis manager and a loyal friend to the nth degree? Thoreau was in a relationship at the time, but when the couple split up 9 months later, he and Aniston reconnected. They've been together ever since. Why is he the right person for me? All I know is that I feel completely seen, says Aniston, and adored in no matter what state. There's no part of me that I don't feel comfortable showing, exposing, and it brings forth the best part of myself because I care about him so much, and he's such a good person. It hurts me to think of anything hurting him. Both Aniston and Thoreau have offices at home, and they spend as much time there as possible, hosting movie nights and make your own pizza nights for friends like Courtney Cox, whose 12-year-old daughter Coco Arquette is Aniston's godchild, Jason Bateman and his wife Amanda Anka, and Lisa Kudrow. One of the upsides of America's ongoing fascination with Aniston is that she's been able to expand her movie star status into a multi-pronged brand, which allows her to be very selective about the film roles she takes. Basically, Aniston's criteria for movie roles right now is you have to be so madly in love with it and think, I will be so upset if I don't go and play this person, she says. Especially these days with Justin in Melbourne, it has to be worth it. Office Christmas Party, for example, was an easy yes. They're like my family, says Aniston, of directors Josh Gordon and Will Speck and co-star Bateman, with whom she made the switch in 2009. Jason and I have been friends since we were in our 20s. He and his wife are over here every week for dinner. And Will and I became best friends while we were making the switch. As soon as they asked me, I said, whatever it is, I want to do it. The film follows the hard-partying Clay, T.J. Miller, who, when his buzzkill CEO sister, Aniston, threatens to shut down the tech company branch he manages, decides to host an epic office Christmas party in an effort to impress a potential client and save everyone's jobs. In other words, it's just a big fat laugh, says Aniston, which is so nice after all these superheroes and sequels. It's fun to throw in a little popcorn comedy, especially when that comedy features dueling Christmas trees on fire and what may be the highest number of employee-on-employee hookups ever captured on film. Let's just say there were a lot of breasts and maybe even some penises floating around, says Aniston. According to Bateman, a good deal of the film's joie de vivre is due to Aniston herself. Anytime I work with Jen or hang out with her, there's that incredible spirit of hers, and it's infectious, he says. When you do a comedy, you really want to feel safe, so you can make a fool of yourself, and she permeates a set with so much good spirit and ease, it's amazing to see what that brings out in people. Another worth-it project for Aniston is a film about real life, NFL crisis manager Denise White. And then there's the drama The Goree Girls, based on one of the first female country and western bands formed by 8 inmates in Texas prison who started performing in the 1940s. We just signed up Mimi Leder to direct, which is incredibly exciting, says Aniston. So hopefully that will happen one of these days. Mostly, though, it's about quality of life at the moment. Aniston is open about the fact that she's still in pursuit of motherhood and is happiest spending time with Thoreau, taking the dogs for runs and raising chickens on their 3-acre property, torturing herself at the gym and cooking together on cheat days. He makes great pastas and Philly cheesesteaks, or he'll come up with these crazy breakfast things where you just go, oh, why did you do that to me? Maybe they'll buy a house nearby in Malibu soon. They just finished remodeling an apartment in New York. Maybe she'll do another TV show. That would be the best, says Aniston. And here, her eyes light up. We had so much fun making Office Christmas Party together that we've been talking about it, doing something for television, something fun and local with Justin, too, of course. It's such a talented group of people, and we work so well together. You just think, we have to find a way to do this again. Aniston herself is uncertain about what's next, but she wears this uncertainty with characteristic equanimity. This is a time when I'm not completely sure what I'm doing, she says. I'm at this sort of crossroads trying to figure out what inspires me deep in my core. What used to make me tick is not necessarily making me tick anymore. The most challenging thing right now is trying to find what it is that makes my heart sing. And now we move to the book titled Listening to the Children, Testimonies from the World's Blind and Partially Sighted Teenagers. This book is a compilation of their reviews and opinions. The article below was submitted by Kelsey Allen, age 16, from Australia, and Kelsey writes, I begin by being born. I was born 2 months premature. Problems occurred in my birth, and as a result, I am vision impaired. On the surface, the only way people know that I have a vision impairment is if the muscles around my right eye decide to go on their lunch break. They slack off, and my eye wanders towards the right. Once the muscles start to get back to work, my eye moves back to normal for a while. The movements are a lot more frequent if I am tired, and are never under my conscious control, much to the amusement of some of my friends, especially if my eye moves fast. At school, someone might sometimes follow my eye and ask, Are you looking at me? Or, What are you looking at? I pause in conversation, replying, Yes, I have a lazy eye. My left eye compensates for the disability of the right. It is the dominant eye. Unless I close it, then my right eye has to work. All of my reading happens through my left eye, and my glasses have only one prescription lens, the left. I also have trouble with depth perception, again, especially if I'm tired. This has caused many near misses and some collisions with stationary and rather hard objects. My severely limited peripheral vision also causes problems. Because of this, I will not be obtaining a driver's license. However, this will be safer for everyone else on the road, hopefully not because of my bad driving skills. When the people in my class at school tell me of their weekend driving lessons or the car that they want to buy, I always stop and think that I won't be having them and that there is no point in my buying a car. However, on the scale of vision-impaired teenagers, I am one of the more fortunate ones, and there are many other people who do not drive a car. I believe that I have been blessed with two of the most fantastic parents. My mom and dad have supported me in everything that I have decided to do in my 16 years of life. They have encouraged me to become independent and to not hide behind my disability. I believe that no young person should, regardless of their disability, a value that I wish to communicate to every teenager. I firmly believe that disability does not dictate what we are able to achieve in our lifetime, and I hope to be an example of that. As a teenager, most of my time is spent at school. I thoroughly enjoy human biology, chemistry, and literature, my favorite subjects at school. I will graduate from high school in 2008 and will sit my final exams for university entry later that year. School for me is no more difficult than it is for my friends with better eyesight than me. I am able to achieve the grades I want and am the top student in some of my classes. I also have very supportive friends at school. Sometimes I can't read what is on the board, but my glasses usually fix that problem. If not, I will ask whoever is sitting next to me what is there, and they will tell me. I have a passion for learning, and I do not allow my vision impairment to prevent me from enjoying school or learning new things. I have discovered an aptitude for music, regardless of my vision impairment, in a way that is a bonus, as music requires little observance with your eyes and more with your ears. If only I had 20/20 hearing. Being a teenager, I have dreams of the future, or hopefully going to university to study music and becoming a music teacher. After the school day, I am almost always playing my flute, either as a soloist or in an ensemble, and love to learn about anything to do with music. I enter flute competitions and practical exams, and love to go to musical recitals or see the West Australian Symphony, which I hope to one day be able to join as a flautist. Having my vision impairment and meeting others with disabilities, I have wanted to further my musical studies into music therapy. I want to become a teacher of Braille music, to be able to teach music to vision-impaired children, to share my passion and knowledge with as many people as possible. When the weekend comes around, I go to work. I currently work part-time at a local coffee shop at Barista, which has given me both independence and many friendships. After telling my boss that I was vision-impaired and that I did not see it to become a problem while working there, I was given a chance and have been there for over a year. Regardless of my degree of impairment, I decided that I wanted a job because I did not want to rely on my parents for money and wanted to gain a sense of personal responsibility. I love working where I am, and the people I work with have made the experience of working part-time all the more worthwhile. I might also catch up with my friends at the movies. I have told each of my friends of my vision impairment, usually because they have noticed the movements of my eye. One of my friends sometimes laughs if my eye is really noticeable, but I laugh with him and am not offended. Others might stop and say, "Your eye just moved weirdly." I always smile because my eye is uniquely me, and I would not change it for the world. One place that my vision impairment is not unusual is the Association for the Blind in Perth, Western Australia. I have been a member all my life and am now a volunteer with the Children's Holiday Program. Most of my school holidays are spent there, working with children of all ages, and I have also made some fantastic friends with vision impairments like me. Having my own vision impairment has enabled me to understand, mentor, and encourage some of the younger children that I have met to participate in activities from which they would have otherwise been excluded. The children that I have met through the Association for the Blind have also taught me how to safely do sighted guiding and see the world through another perspective. I see myself as somewhat of an ambassador of the association. I have introduced a number of my friends to the volunteering I do during the holidays and have been a musician at functions in the main offices in Perth. I guess being vision impaired has given me the drive to further excel in anything I want to do, whether it be academically or musically, as I want to show people that there are no boundaries set by disabilities. Through the Association for the Blind, I have also had such opportunities to further my musical studies through scholarships and awards, and in particular meet other teenagers like me on local and international levels by entering this essay competition. Like other teenagers, I love to socialize and meet new people and take any opportunity to further myself in any way possible. I am still able to live a normal life with my vision impairment and still achieve my goals if I set my mind to them. I was a finalist in the Western Australian Youth Awards in 2005 for being an inspiration to others my age, and hope to continue to inspire any other people I may meet. And now from Teen Inc. Online Magazine, we have the following article entitled "What Rules, What Curfews?" submitted by Clarence C. of Brooklyn, New York. The article reads as follows. Parents give too many rules nowadays, but without rules, teenagers have no guidance. Teens no longer believe in rules and curfews. They believe that now, since they are older, they are more mature and can be more responsible. But truly, most teens abuse this privilege and disobey their parents. Many of my friends don't have curfews, but they don't dare abuse this freedom. Other teenagers will stay out late. Their parents call, but they refuse to answer their calls. These kids are irresponsible. They believe it's cool to disobey their parents. I'm 16 years old, a current student. I also have rules and curfews that I have to abide by, but I don't complain because I believe my parents make wise decisions. Parents' first priority is to always protect and nurture their kids. They give rules and curfews to protect you. They want to know where you are and when you will be home. They want you to be safe. They want to raise you and see you grow up as a successful adult. You, until then, are the parents' responsibility. Every kid now has a different role model. A parent's job is like your role model's job. We look up to and respect our role models for what he or she does, and we want to grow up to be just like them. Why can't we look up to your parents as role models? They are truly the real heroes here. They guide and watch over us, feed and nurture us until we can be where we want to be. But we can't be where you want to be later until you are taken care of as a young adult right now. What if your parents didn't care about you anymore? They wouldn't need to watch over you, no need to feed you and nurture you, and they won't need to care where you are and when you will be home. They wouldn't do what a parent is supposed to do. Then you will be left all alone and no one to care about you anymore. What if you obey your parents? Your relationship and communication with them will be better. They will allow you to have a little more freedom when you show them that you respect and appreciate what they have done for you. After all, that is basically what every teen wants. It is true that making your own decision is really cool, but if all kids started making their own decisions and didn't listen to their parents, then what is the point of listening to anything or your parents say? You won't need to get a good education anymore. You don't have to shower and sleep. You don't have to eat the dinner your parents cook, and you don't even have to come home. We all love to be independent, but without rules, teens truly cannot survive. Many teens have curfews and don't abuse them. Even teens that don't have curfews don't abuse them. But they're not the problem. The problem is teens that do abuse this privilege. If kids listen to their parents, their homes will be better places. The parents will trust their kids because they showed them they are responsible young adults. And slowly, that trust can lead to gaining more independence. After all, teens do need freedom, but there is an exchange for that freedom, and that exchange is to obey the rules. And again, from teeninc.com online magazine, we have this article entitled When I Grow Up, submitted by Sarah D. of Wyckoff, New Jersey. Sarah says, in kindergarten, my class was asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? Crayons danced across sheets of paper to illustrate our dream occupations. Our drawings were hung in the hallway for our parents to see at back-to-school night. I remember looking down the line and seeing pictures of ballerinas dancing, firefighters putting out a blaze, and astronauts sleeping across the moon, careers that were seen as typical dreams of five-year-olds. My picture showed a stick figure with brown hair holding a carton of orange juice over a large rectangle that was supposed to be a counter. Underneath was my barely legible handwriting. When I grow up, I want to work at the market basket because it would be fun to swipe orange juice across the scanner. To this day, my parents won't let me forget that out of everything I could have aspired to be, my five-year-old self wished to work at the local grocery store. When we are young, questions of what we want to be when we grow up are common, yet we are not expected to respond with an answer that is likely to come true. However, when we become teens, we are asked the very same question twice as often. The difference is, now we are supposed to answer with confidence. Teens are expected to know exactly what we want to be and how we are going to achieve that goal. Not all of us can be so sure. Even though I am in high school, I cannot answer convincingly, but I don't consider that a bad thing. Now I am supposed to know what I want to spend my life doing at the age of 40. When I think about the future, I definitely don't see myself working at the market basket. But in reality, if that was what would make me happy, I would do it. So the next time someone asks me what I want to be happy when I grow up, I will simply say, happy. Happiness is a destination for everyone. We may want to walk different paths in life, but we all want to be happy wherever we end up. Choose your path, but don't worry too much about choosing wisely. Make a mistake or two and try new things. But always remember, if you're not happy, you are not at the end of your journey yet. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. We hope you are enjoying our revamped format and broader content presentations intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, and we look forward to hearing your remarks. Be sure to listen next time, and remember that this broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. I am Alida Khan, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, wishing you a lovely, safe, and productive week. Until next time, I leave you with this inspirational quote, no matter how you feel, get up, dress up, and show up, and never give up. For comments, questions, or suggestions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138, and we would love to hear from you.